the world of fantasy, okay? There are two ways of knowing when something is a fantasy. One is if there's a contradiction. In other words, you're living a certain life that you find contradictions in. Or two, you see consequences, okay? Then there is the investigation of the nature of the fantasy, how the nature of the fantasy is not in line with reality. Like, let's say, for instance, competition is your evaluation, who you are, is in relationship to another in a particular activity, okay? So therefore, you see the whole thing is crazy, okay? Because you see the nature of the fantasy, okay? What I'd like to do today is to show you a different way of knowing when a thing is a fantasy, and it helps understand fantasy from a different angle. I will take an example like basketball, okay? I will take basketball. Let's just understand the activity of playing basketball. You have a big ball that you try to get into a hoop, right? You have to dribble and be able to pass, okay? Basically, those are the activities, okay? Now, there are certain people that are extremely talented in this area of throwing the ball into the hoop or dribbling or passing. And for some reason, they get paid millions upon millions of dollars for this talent, and fans spend hours upon hours of their life talking about it, watching the sport, arguing about it, and actually getting angry about it, okay? So when you see the investment, the emotional investment is so much beyond the activity, then you recognize that that activity is only based on some fantasy. Okay, so what we're showing, and when you analyze the fantasy from this point of view, so then you have to, in other words, like for instance, all sports are basically competition. Now, what we've done in the past, we've analyzed the competition, either the idea of competition to show the contradictions in it, or we showed the, in competition, we showed the consequences of competition, or we showed the fantasy of competition. But however, in analyzing the fantasy from this point of view, you cannot take the universal, but you must take the particular activity. Right. And the next example that I'd like to give is acting, okay? Now, the acting itself, what you get out of acting is at the end, when you finish acting, people clap, okay? Now, the pleasure of that clapping is based on an interpretation in your mind that you interpret that noise as being that people accept you, okay? Which the interpretation could be wrong, because maybe people are being polite, okay? So the thing is that the whole pleasure is based on some interpretation that people accept you, okay? Now, again, you evaluate the energy because of that activity. So we pay people millions of dollars. They become famous, right? And we spend hours upon hours of going to the supermarket and getting the gossip columns about the rich and famous. And we spend hours talking about it, okay? And the truth is that we've made these people that really their activity is a slave activity, because their whole activity is only to entertain, to make others happy, and they are happy when we clap. In other words, their enjoyment is when other people clap, and they have satisfied and made happy others, which is a slave activity, and yet they become the famous one, the wealthy one, and we look up to them as greats when they are not doing slave activity for us. They finally, that's a contradiction, really. The last point that I'm making is a contradiction, okay? But the fact is that in what we're doing now, it's just the idea of that activity of acting, spending a lifetime of training only, in other words, an actor spends a lifetime of training his life, okay, only so that he should hear clapping, which he has to interpret. That is the output of energy, which is way beyond the activity itself. The question is people do it for money? If they're doing it for money, then that's a different activity. Okay? In other words, like this, then we'll have to analyze money. If they do not enjoy fame, but they happen to be good actors and they could make money that way, that's fine. I mean, that is a practical thing. Okay? In other words, like for instance with basketball, there's certain people that they can't exercise only when they compete. So I would say, yeah, to get exercise, it's worth it to play basketball, but it's a practical thing. They have no other way of getting exercise. I'm talking about evaluating where you don't use these things for the practical, where you relate to it only where you see you put out the energy, that emotional energy, like the hours and hours that you think about. In other words, if you, let's say, for instance, you just exercise. So you go out, you do your exercise, and that's it. You understand? It's just an activity which either you enjoy or you do it because of health reasons or both. But once the activity where the emotional energy is so far beyond the practical, then you recognize that there's some type of fantasy driving you, okay? In other words, the nature of the fantasy is where you have an incorrect view of life and you make decisions, like, for instance, jealousy and competition. Jealousy and competition is I evaluate myself in relationship to others. So I could do one of two things. Either I could take away the object, destroy the object that you have, or I could kill you or take away in two ways, either physically, I mean, if a person is a murderer, or I could gossip about you and lower your reputation where you're equal to nothing. And competition is I outdo you, so what you have is of no value because I'm better than you. You see? So it's really the same emotion. What you're doing is you have a very incorrect view of life where you spend your whole life evaluating yourself in relationship to others. You realize, well, that's stupid. I mean, once you put it in those terms, you actually see the stupidity of it, you see? But what we're trying to analyze now is the activity, what the activity is, and when you put so much energy into somebody that has talent, and it's like it's way beyond which it deserves, then you see that it is some type of a fantasy. We're not defining what the fantasy is, but we're showing you a certain aspect of the fantasy. I just want to clarify, it was a very good point was made, that most of my examples are what the public has accepted, and they put all the energy because it's easy to see, but sometimes you see a particular individual that puts all his energy into a particular area and spends his life thinking about it. And even though nobody else thinks about it, but this person spends his life and puts more energy into it, more beyond which it is of value, so then it could be on the particular, it could be on that particular person. But however, I'm just giving examples which you could obviously see in the society around us. Okay. What I'd like to discuss today is comedy. Okay, comedy is sometimes a good thing. Like you find by Eliyahu or Elijah, they had a test of who's the right God, and they had 450 of the idol Baal on one side and Eliyahu on the other side. And each one had a bull that they were going to set up for sacrifice, but they weren't going to set a fire to it. And the fire was supposed to come down from the god. The god is supposed to cause the fire. Now, when it came the time for the Baal to pray to their god, so it says here, when they were praying to the god, and it was at noontime, Elijah mocked them and said, "Cry out in a louder voice, for he is a god. Perhaps he's conversing, or pursuing enemies, or relieving himself. Perhaps he is asleep, and he will awaken." So you see that Eliyahu used comedy, you know, to bring about a certain point, that it was necessary in that situation to bring out a point, because the whole nation was standing there, and that was the method that he used to bring out a certain point. So you see, comedy can be a very good thing. In other words, the question is that this mockery, and that's not comedy. The answer is that if you listen to a lot of comedians, they mock certain types of people, and everybody laughs. We might not consider it nice if you do it to a particular person, but it is comedy. In other words, mockery is you put something in a funny way so that, in this case, you want the person to look ridiculous. You see? Now, sometimes a lot of comedy that we laugh at, I mean, if you look at the sitcoms, many times the joke is that somebody, they're laughing at one of the actors of what he's doing, you understand? So therefore, they're mocking a certain type of person, putting down a certain type of person. So therefore, mockery is definitely a part of comedy. It's true, and they can mock themselves. I mean, that's also a type of comedy. Now the question is, right or wrong? Is mockery a good type of comedy? Well, the answer is, if you're mocking a particular person, no, it's wrong. Over here, in this case, mockery was, we're talking to the public. He couldn't sit down and give a philosophical discussion there. And he had to bring out a point, and he was trying to bring out a point of the nature of their god, that they relate to their god like a physical human being. And so therefore, he says, you relate to them like a physical human being. So I'm just making fun of the way you're doing it. But he's talking to the public. There is no time to get into a philosophical discourse. I don't know if the people would want to even listen to philosophy at that time. But mockery was a good way of getting across the idea to the public. In other words, a sharp comedian brings out points that the public doesn't recognize. They just see a thing in general, but he brings out a certain point to show the weakness of the other person, or a person in general, you see? Now, the thing is Eliyahu had to show the weakness of idolatry. And therefore, at that situation, the only way of getting it across was through mockery, which is a type of comedy. In other words, there is really no act that I know of that is wrong. It's always the situation and the motive that makes it right or wrong. We kill people, and it's a good thing. And when we go to war against evil people, or we have the death penalty, I mean, that's good. Murder is wrong. So the act is of itself is not wrong. The same thing with the mockery. Inherently, you can't say mockery is wrong. The only act that is inherently wrong is idolatry. In other words, if you look at the verse 21, it says, Elijah approached all the people and said, "How long will you dance between two opinions? If Hashem is the God, go after him, and if the Baal, go after it." So you see that the people were in doubt. and therefore mockery brought out the view clearly of the false god, but the people were in doubt. In other words, your question is, if they totally believed in the Baal, they wouldn't be able to see a flaw to it. Yeah, there's certain people that it would not help. They're totally blind. On the contrary, if you mock them, they'll hate you. But people that are in doubt don't recognize which is right and which is wrong. They sometimes go this way, sometimes go that way, because they're insecure. So therefore, mockery in this case helped them to point out the weakness of the Baal. In other words, the comedy in the wrong situation would bring out anger. If this was the wrong situation, and we all have to evaluate that this was the situation to help bring out the idea. But if it was a wrong situation, it could bring out anger. If you make fun of something that the person believes in dearly, then at that time comedy could get them angry. Okay? But the public wasn't that. We're not talking about the people that the priests of the idol Baal. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the public. The public wasn't that. Okay? So therefore comedy was to point out the weakness in the Baal that was acceptable in that situation. That takes care of the philosophical idea of comedy. Now we get to everyday life comedy, okay? Everyday life comedy is usually an outlet for a certain conflict, like a certain amount of aggression or an incorrect view of sex, and you bring out certain ideas of the unconscious, and a person has a certain relief of it, and so they have relief from their unconscious, okay? So in that way, comedy is also a good, because it, unless you're a person that's trying to cure yourself of these unconscious things, sometimes control forces the buildup of the conflict so you could view the conflict more when you're actually dealing with the conflict. In other words, when you're dealing with the conflict, then it's not the best thing to have an outlet for the conflict, because you want the conflict to build so you could view it in your mind better. It'll come into your mind. Well, if you have an outlet, so then the conflict is lowered, so then it's hard to see. But if you're not dealing with the conflict itself, then comedy is a good way. It's another way, like for instance, exercise is a good way of also getting rid of conflict. So you don't get rid of it, you have an outlet for the conflict. So the same thing, comedy is a good thing to have it's to use in different situations. Sometimes we're in a terrible strait. So comedy relieves the tension for certain people, for people that have a certain sense of humor. So comedy helps. For some people, it doesn't help. Comedy doesn't help. You understand? But where it does help, it's a tremendous, like, for instance, in teaching, comedy is a good thing because it makes a lighter atmosphere. Like somebody said, speaking, or someone where you're speaking publicly. And comedy awakens, you deal with an unconscious thing, and there's an enjoyable outlet for it, and then you can enjoy, you become freer to enjoy the class and listen to the lecture, whatever you're doing. So there's different situations where it is practical, where comedy is definitely a practical thing, okay, for the outlet, okay? What we're talking about is where the fantasy, the way you use comedy to such an extent, where, like, for instance, we honor comedians, you see, or we look at them as something great or special, I think that is where we're taking fantasy. That shows that the fantasy, it's not just an outlet, but you're looking for it. You're being drawn to it, and you're going in that direction. And if you are moving in that direction, then you're moving in the direction of the unconscious. Because, in other words, one thing, you have the unconscious and you need an outlet. But another thing is where you're being drawn to it and going more and more in that direction. So it shows a level of energy put into comedy, which is way beyond the reality dictates. And so that's what we've been saying about fantasy, that we have to recognize where people put so much energy in certain areas that the energy that they put in shows that they're drawn to it way beyond that which is practical, okay? And when that's another aspect that we said of analyzing, besides showing the consequences and the contradictions of fantasy, we said we're also trying to show a new aspect, the aspect of where people put in a tremendous amount of energy. They're like, for instance, they watch a show and they can't miss one. It's not a matter of I need an outlet, I'll watch the comedy just for relaxation, but it's a I must do it. I have to do it. I can't miss it. I don't want to miss it. You see, that act is more beyond which you should be relating to comedy. So they're bringing it out. I'm not saying that comedy is wrong. I'm saying the extent that you use it to is wrong. If you philosophically, if you need it for a philosophical situation like Alio, that's definitely good. If you have a conflict and you need an outlet and comedy gives you an outlet, or if you have a situation where comedy could diffuse the tension, then I'm all for conflict, and conflict is a good thing. Or even watching TV where you watch a comedy. So the thing is, if you need the outlet, so then, yes, you need the outlet, so use it. But what I am saying is where you go too far, where you go beyond where you can't miss the show, where you start talking about the show and you start following the lives of these people, you understand, like they become idols, you see, that's that comedy is going too far. That's beyond. And it's leading, and you're going in the direction of the unconscious emotion, whichever area of the unconscious that comedy is helping with. We are in chapter 15, verse 8. And it says, the sacrifices of the wicked is an abomination of God, and the prayers of those that are straight is his desire or is his will. First question, what is the sacrifices that are wicked? By straight, it means means people that are righteous. They think correctly, so they're righteous. Okay? What's the comparison between sacrifices and prayers? And the last question is, what is an abomination of God? In other words, God doesn't have any qualities, so it must be some action. Okay? So what is the action of abomination of God? From what I have seen, wherever I've come across the word abomination, it seems to be, in other words, like this, there is an act that you do that's a direct cause. In other words, if you smoke, you're going to get cancer or emphysema. It's a direct cause between smoking and the disease. Okay? However, let's say, for instance, where I hang around evil people, there's no direct cause between hanging around them and doing evil. Usually, there's hanging around them, and then that causes me, as I get worse, as I become more attached to them, so then I start doing evil. In other words, it's not the, in other words, there is a step between in other words, there are two steps. In other words, usually when there's a cause, smoking is a direct link between smoking and cancer. But here, there's not a direct link, but however, I hang around people, that gets me attached to them, and then I start acting like them. Then I get the consequences of my action. You see? So it's not a direct to the consequences, but I first hang around them, then I do action, then I get consequences. You see? So abomination is a step before where it's harder to see the consequences. Sometimes you need the prophecy, like to tell you. I mean, but once you see it, then In fact, by Noah, it says also it was an abomination to God that they did sexual promiscuity. Okay? But that wasn't the cause of the destruction, because sexual promiscuity leads to violence, and it's the violence that led to destruction of the generation of the flood. Okay, that's a Ramban and Nachmanides on Bereshis. He shows how there's the sexual promiscuity, which there's really nothing wrong with. But what happened, what's wrong with it, is that it leads to freedom. I could do what I want. Once I could do what I want, once I have that freedom, so then I start, in other words, once I allow my unconscious desires of sex to be free, then I can allow my unconscious aggression to be free. And then that is the reason for destruction. You see? So the thing is that abomination, whoever comes across abomination, you'll always find that it's not a direct link. Anyway, that's what I found all the time. It's not a direct link, but it's two steps. In other words, now we have to find the sacrifices of the wicked, such a wicked person that it's not a direct wickedness, but however, there are two steps to that leads to it. In other words, there's a direct consequence of robbing the bank and going to prison. It's a direct cause. You understand? But however, hanging around wicked people, there's nothing wrong. There's no consequence of hanging around them. But that will lead to robbing a bank, and from there to going to jail. The thing is, the question that we had before was, what is the comparison between the sacrifices of the wicked and the prayers of the righteous, okay? Prayers means that my mind is working. What is prayer? Prayer means the knowledge, that if I understand what I'm praying, so then there's a certain knowledge of God, either that I'm reviewing or expressing knowledge, but it's knowledge. And repentance or turning to God is always through knowledge. But however, the sacrifice of the wicked means that there is no thought with the sacrifice. Sacrifices are supposed to be with thought. Without thought, that's what he calls it, the sacrifices of the wicked. Many times the later prophets would say, God doesn't want your sacrifices. What do you mean God doesn't want your sacrifices? I mean, the Chumash, one whole book is devoted to Leviticus is totally devoted to sacrifices. You understand? How do you say God doesn't want your sacrifices? The answer is that the sacrifices are just superficial. It's just an act where you attach to the act. So therefore, it seems to you that that's what you wanted to say now. So it seems to you that there's absolute, that I'm doing the right thing. You don't see the consequence. In other words, you think you are doing the right act. Person thinks that the act in and of itself is the right thing. In Judaism, it's not only the act, but it's the motive behind the act that's also there. You see? So therefore, that step is hidden. You see, to the people, the wicked people, what they're talking about wicked here, is that they're doing correct act, but however, they do not see the motive and the ideas behind the act. They don't see the true ideas. And therefore, they don't notice it. They don't notice. So therefore, they're going to start, after a while, they'll start doing evil things in the world because they only think of the act and they don't analyze the motives behind it and the precision of all aspects of it. And therefore, they can make mistakes. Now, once again, the sacrifice is, I think, the act of sacrificing itself brings me to God, brings me close to God. You see, the act of sacrificing itself. But the truth, what brings you close to God is the ideas of God. That would bring you close to God, not the sacrifices. You see? So therefore, what he's saying is that that's an abomination to God. because there's a step hidden, and that step which is hidden is the step of the ideas, that you don't see the ideas. Shamshin Raphael Hirsch calls this a mummified religion, where it has form on the outside and nothing, no life on the inside. Has the form of a mummy, it has the form of a human being, but it has no life inside. So he says that's this type of religion, where they live the act of religion, but there's no motive. There's no they don't see the ideas of Torah. They don't see the ideas of God, and they don't see any of these ideas. So therefore, there's a lacking. There's lacking to the act. The act is lacking. In other words, you think you're going to get rewards for it when really you're going to be getting consequences. That's the abomination here. Where you're going in one direction, where you think you're going to be rewarded for your actions, and really you're not going to be rewarded for your actions, and since you don't see the true ideas, then you're going to do it incorrectly. You're going to relate to it incorrectly, and therefore there will be consequences. In other words, by abomination, we mean there's some step missing, okay? In other words, an example that we gave, that a person hangs around evil, there's no direct consequence, okay? Over here, the hidden, in other words, over here, the abomination is what's hidden, is hidden that you need to have the knowledge, that it's not a complete act. In other words, by abomination, there is some idea that is hidden from the human being. Over here, what's hidden, he thinks he's doing the correct act. He thinks he's relating to God. What the abomination, what's hidden from him, is that he's not relating correctly to the correct act. He's not relating to the correct act because he doesn't have, because he doesn't know that he needs these ideas, and that's hidden to him, so he thinks that he's doing the right thing. That's the abomination. The abomination is that the act is not complete, and he doesn't realize it when he thinks that the act is complete, so there's something hidden. That's why it's called abomination. In other words, when it says the prayer of the righteous, it says prayers without sacrifice. In other words, prayers meaning the ideas. When you're speaking, you must see the ideas, okay? So therefore, it is the ideas without the act is more important than the act. In other words, that will satisfy you getting close to God on greater than a person that... that does the act without that does the act without the idea. Doing the act without the ideas is an abomination. It's wrong. It's wicked. You see? But doing the ideas without the act, you understand? Of course, the highest level is doing the ideas with the act. That is the perfect person. But if a person only does the tefillah, only the prayer, and he doesn't bring the sacrifice, that is still closer to God than the, but it's not perfect. The perfect is where you do the complete act with the correct idea. That's perfect. But he's saying the essence of the act, the essence of the act is the idea. That's what we see from prayer. In other words, the action is correct, but the intention is wrong. In other words, the thoughts are wrong. The term abomination, from what I see, is that there's some, in other words, you have to take an extra step. There's some step missing. In the example of hanging around people, what's missing is that I'm actually, when you first hang around them, you say, yeah, I like hanging around them. They're a lot of fun, but I wouldn't do what they're doing. You understand? You're missing that information. I wouldn't do what they're doing. But after a while, you get used to it and you start doing it. You see? The same thing with over here. You do the act and you think the act in and of itself is the correct thing, but you don't see that you need the ideas also. That's what's missing. Right, again, in other words, if I do the wrong act like murder, But I think that it's nothing wrong. I don't see anything wrong. In fact, I think it might be right. The guy deserves to be dead, you know. I work it out, I rationalize in my mind. But there I'm doing the wrong act. What I rationalize, I don't rationalize, is not an abomination. What's an abomination is that I do the correct act and I'm missing something, or I'm not doing anything really wrong, but I'm missing a step. Like, for instance, I hang around with bad people. There is inherently nothing wrong in hanging around with bad people. I'm not doing anything wrong. I just go to their parties. I like a good party. They have good parties. But when I'm hanging around them, I start becoming attached to them. I want to be a person, wants to be accepted, whatever the emotion is. After a while, they start acting out the same thing. But they don't notice. They don't. Then by abomination, I'm not doing anything wrong. You see? And I don't notice that really either there's a step missing, or in the act, I'm doing a correct act, but the idea is missing. There's something missing in something that is not wrong. I'm doing an act which is not wrong, or it isn't even correct act. Like with the sacrifice, it's a correct act. Hanging around with bad people, there's nothing wrong in that, you see? But there's something missing, a step missing. So where I'm hanging around people, the step is missing, that you don't realize emotions change after a while you hang around with people. On the other hand, where you're doing the correct act, you think, well, I'm doing the correct act, so that's it. Then you don't realize that the correct act is not complete without the idea. I think that's the point. Okay, so abomination, once again, is where the act is not inherently wrong, but however, there's a step missing which makes it wrong. Okay, there's something that you don't realize. Either there's consequences that you don't realize, or the act is not complete. Something is missing in your relationship to this act that you don't realize the consequences. That's abomination. But the next verse, verse 9, says, it's an abomination of God, the ways of the wicked. And he who chases after righteousness is love. The question is that the ways of the wicked is not an abomination. I mean, the ways of the wicked is really an evil thing. So the question is, what does it mean, the ways of the wicked? Or the path of the wicked. It could either be the way, or there could be a path of the wicked. In other words, by love, that means love by God, because the first one was an abomination of God or to God, and the next one is love, means he's loved by God. The Mitzvah David says exactly what you're saying, okay? Mitzvah David says that this verse is talking about where a person goes after something, but he's stopped by, let's say, something in the laws of nature, something happens. You understand? Let's say you're going out to rob a store, and you get a flat tire and you can't do it. You understand? So you can't complete the act. You understand? Or another person is trying to do a righteous act and something stops them. So the thing is that here again, I think it's like universalizing the last verse. Like they're both one right after the other and they're both using abomination. I think it's making, you know, before we're only talking about sacrifices and prayer. But here it's saying, in general, if you strive to do the correct act, you strive to do the correct act, but you don't make it, you're still loved by God. Because your intention is not, in other words, the act is important. You must do the act, but the essence is the intention. That's what it keeps saying. You understand? So if you want to do an evil act and you're not successful, so you might think, like, for instance, in a court of law, let's say I was going to rob a bank and find out that I was going to rob a bank, but I got a flat. I never made it. They can't put me in jail for that because I didn't do the act. So it seems like that the act is the essence. What King Solomon is emphasizing is the essence is the motive, not the act. If you, for some reason, you don't complete the act, then you are rewarded for the motive. If you just have motive without an act, that's not a real motive. You understand? So then the motive is not complete. It's not real. But where you desire to do the act and you try, you chase after it, but you don't quite make it. Or you do the, whether for good or for evil, then insofar as God is concerned, your intention is the essence, and that's who you are. In other words, the verse is saying the essence to God is who you are, and your actions is based on what your nature is. So therefore, once you see the truth about righteousness and you chase after it, even though sometimes you're not successful for whatever reason, you're loved by God. But if you run after evil and if you're not successful, the same thing is it's an abomination, and there will be consequences. And loved by God means that you will be successful because you live the correct life, even though you're not successful in the action. But however, since you are guided by that idea, love means, must mean, and before the word will, must mean that you will be successful. In other words, let's say, for instance, I have intention to do good, but I'm too lazy to carry it out. That is not intention. That is not the intention we're talking about. Intention that we're talking about is where I have a desire and I'm willing to do it. And there's nothing within me that stops me, but something outside of me that stops me. So therefore, I am a person that's the nature. In other words, the nature of the person is to do good, or the nature of the person is to do evil, even if he's not successful. So therefore, God is interested in what the nature of the person is. That is the essence. That's these two verses is trying to bring out from two different angles that the essence of the person, in other words, you must have intention and you must do the act. If you have an intention but I'm too lazy to do it, that is neither a good act because you didn't do the act, and you're a person that it's not real to you to do this because laziness is able to win over. You understand? So the thing is that is not a correct. Correct intention means I see the value of the act, and therefore I'm going to do it, and nothing will stop me from doing it. I'm driven to do it. You see? That's what it means. He chases after. He's driven to do it. But if he's not successful, something stops him that he can't help. The same thing with evil. I mean, he really has intention to do evil, but however, something stops him. You see? Something outside of him stops him. So you would think, well, he didn't do anything wrong. You see, you can't go to jail, so there's nothing wrong. Like they have a proverb. You're only wrong if you're caught. It's only wrong if you're caught. You see? According to Torah, that is not acceptable. What is acceptable according to Torah is who you are. And therefore, you actually really try to do it. Okay. Verse 10. Everybody knows what Musa is, right? Musa is it's either rebuke or it's the study of incorrect acts, of acts that are incorrect, either because it leads to consequences. Well, because it's unjust. Like, for instance, smoking is not unjust. It's not an unjust act. It just leads to cancer. It's a foolish act, you see? But if I punch you in the mouth, that's an evil act. That's unjust, okay? So Musa is where, like the things that we're talking about here, that tell you what leads to a good act, what leads to bad act, what emotions, what knowledge you need, that's the study of Musa. What about Musa Ra? Musa, that is evil. And it's La'ozei Barach, to leave the path. That's one part of the verse. And the second part of the verse is he who hates Tochacha. Tochacha is a synonym for Musa. Yomus, he will die. Okay? That's the verse. And once again, Musa Ra, Musa that is evil, to leave the path. Period. Second half of the verse. So Musa is Musa that is wrong, incorrect. Okay? And what is incorrect Musa? So evil, so incorrect Musa, incorrect guidance, is that which will lead you off the path. Lead you away from the path of Torah. Okay? And he who hates Musa, he will die. Okay? Now, the thing is that it doesn't say in the first half he'll die. It just says that if you have bad Musa, it'll lead you off the path. And if it leads you off the path, then you can die. That's how you died. I mean, what we mean by dying, whenever it says dying, either it means a bad life or you'll have a shortened life because you're living an incorrect life, so it's going to harm you. So sometimes it means, it can mean both, that the very life that you're living is a terrible life and it leads to death. Now, if you have the wrong Musa, then if you have the wrong guidance, so then that should also lead to death because you're living the incorrect life. And it'll definitely have incorrect ramifications in your life. Even before you die, you will not be having a good life. So the question is, shouldn't it be, you should die, you should be on both of them, not just on the second half. Okay, the first half of the verse is a person that accepts Musa, but however, he accepts guidance. So if you have something to tell him, he's willing to listen. But if he's not trained to think and to check out what is good guidance, what is bad guidance, so he could pick up some bad guidance, and he could sometimes go off the path. But there is a possibility he could straighten himself out, because he's still willing to listen. There's no guarantee he's going to die. If he keeps getting bad ideas and he keeps going with these bad ideas, so then after a while it will destroy him. But there's no guarantee. It's not a certainty. Because since he's willing to listen, he might find somebody that'll guide him correctly and they'll see the truth and he'll change his ways because he's open. But the second person who can't listen to ideas, that he doesn't want to change anything that affects his life, he doesn't want to listen to, that's going to change, that he can't listen to Musa, that person will definitely die. Again, the first guy can't discern between the truth and not the truth. So he hears Musa, it sounds good, he'll accept it. Like if you read some of the advice that they have in the these women's journals, you understand? Some of them are catastrophic. They're really bad. You know what I mean? They can really harm you. So you got to be careful. But it sounds nice. It sounds so nice. When you read it, it sounds, wow, this sounds good. But if you really stop to think about it, but anyway, so that, but that person, at least if somebody tells them, at least they're willing to listen, so if somebody tells them a true idea, they might bring them back on the path, okay? In other words, it's a person that cannot discern between good ideas and bad ideas, and just takes advice without thinking. The second, the guy cannot take advice. He will certainly have a bad life. Right, the question is, what's the problem with the second guy? I mean, he doesn't, in other words, he doesn't want to change who he is. In other words, he's stuck in his life, his personality. He cannot look outside. He cannot look at reality outside his personality. A person that's willing to accept advice could listen to something that outside his personality is a little different. But if he can't discern between good advice and bad advice, he could be in trouble. You understand? But if somebody guides him to the correct advice and trains him how to get it correct advice and how to make distinctions between the correct advice and the incorrect advice, So that person will be saved. We see from this verse, Chaim wants to say, we see from this verse that many times most people think that that to be close to God, it's only a good mind. Of course, if you have a good mind, you have better ideas of God. But what's worse is that it doesn't matter if you have a good mind or a bad mind, if you have bad emotions, that's totally destructive. It is better to have good emotions and a weak mind than a good mind with bad emotions. In other words, the first half doesn't mean weak-minded, not necessarily weak-minded, but he wasn't trained to discern between correct, how to discern when he's getting good advice or bad advice. So if he has advice that sounds good, he accepts it, but he didn't learn to analyze it, to think about it. We're going back to verse 8, okay? We're going back to verse 8. Verse 8 says that the that if you do the correct act, but you don't have the correct idea, the correct motive, so that's an abomination to God. Simultaneously, we say that if a person does the correct act for the wrong motive, we should encourage that, because then it might lead to the correct emotion, so the correct motive. So the question is, how can we advocate somebody doing the wrong thing and simultaneously saying that that it might work out? The answer is that is human nature. Human nature is that there's a certain development. Okay, let's say for instance you start out with a child. And you train him to do the correct acts, but he definitely doesn't have the knowledge to do the correct. He doesn't have the knowledge of Torah. He's not developed. His mind is not developed yet, and he's going to do the act for his own personal, because of his parents. He wants to satisfy his parents, or for whatever reason, he might, because he's raised in that type of home. He has religious emotions, and we do advocate that, but we do say the act is wrong. The act is wrong, but because of a human being, when he does the correct act, so therefore he will start questioning and start investigating why he's doing it. An intelligent person will start questioning, so it can come to the correct motive. That's the process that we have. Even studying Torah, we say you should learn Torah, even though it's impossible to have the correct motive for the study of Torah when you start out. Because after a while, you will gain the correct motive. You will see the benefit, the truth about Torah, and therefore you'll have the correct motive. But the thing is, the act itself simultaneously, in other words, let's say, for instance, a kid that's first learning how to drive. He has to get behind the wheel. I wouldn't let a kid, it is wrong to let a kid of 16 to be behind the wheel, even with an adult there. He can't drive. He doesn't know how to drive. But yet we have to give him a license to train on that. Nobody would ever drive. There has to be a time where he drives, where you're teaching him, you're educating him. You can't say it's right to let a kid that doesn't know how to drive behind the wheel. But that's the way life is. You have to start out where I don't know it that well, and either I don't know the act that well, and it's dangerous, but that's the only way of learning it, or I do the act, and I don't have the correct motive. It's just, that's human, that's the way the human being develops. So you have to know simultaneously that the act is not correct, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. You shouldn't stop doing the act. You should continue doing the act, and then try to change your motive. We're in chapter 15, verse 23, and it says, happy is the man who has an answer in his mouth and something in the correct time. How wonderful. Okay? What are the questions? And the first question is, what does the first half have to do with the second half? In other words, what does it mean a man is happy with the answers of his mouth? Well, what does that mean? And what does it mean? Something in the correct time. How wonderful. What does that mean? And what do they have to do with each other? Right. What I'd like to do is just go over how to make a decision. Okay? General Patton says the way you do it, he says, he was studying war, right? So he says you study different battles. You study the strategy of both generals. You see what the weather affected the strategy. You see how the terrain affects the strategy. And you see how the strategy worked. Then he says it's not to remember this or that battle. He says, but when you're thinking about your particular battle, so then you bring through the correct idea for your battle. Okay? Right? Taking that as a picture of what we're saying here is it says, happy is the man who has studied all the ideas of all, he was talking about battles. We were talking about decisions in life, so we're talking about Mishlei. He knows all the principles of Mishlei. That's the first step in making a decision. But now when you're in a particular situation, there is a step to associate to the correct idea. If you don't associate, you could associate to a correct idea that doesn't fit in this particular thing, it'll destroy you. It's the wrong decision. You have to associate to the correct principle or create a principle for your particular situation. So we're talking about universals and particulars. The first thing is you're happy, you study the universals. We sit here in class and we all enjoy the ideas. Now the question is when you're in a particular situation and you have to make a decision, do you have the correct associative mind that you associate to the correct thing? If you don't, that's a problem. There's two steps in making a decision. There's first to have the universal of how to make decisions in your particular area, whatever area it is. And then the second thing is to associate them. That particular thing you have to associate them. In other words, the question is why did the first half it says that it says happy is the man who has the correct answer. It has the correct answer means that he has all the universals. You see? That the answer is in his mouth. It means that he has all the universals. But then which universal you use at a particular time or a particular situation, that's a different type of procedure. It's associating and working out from the fact that you're dealing the particular, what principle is going to guide you. You understand? And sometimes you have to create a new principle because of the situation, see a principle that you didn't see before. But it has to be working with the particular situation. Let's say in Pesach, you're making a decision in Halacha. First, you have to go through all the different ideas of Pesach. Then, when you get a particular case, which principles work in this case, that you have to have the associative powers to associate to the correct principle. But you must start with the principle. In other words, we're going over the pasuk. Happy is the man who has all the answers. He has the principle. He learned if it's musa, so he learned through Mishlei, and he has all the ideas and the principles. If it's in halacha, so he has all the concepts of halacha. And then he also has the ability in the particular situation to use the correct universal to bring forward the correct universal, to associate to the correct universal, abstract from the case the correct universal that is necessary for this case. Verse 24 says the path of life is for the thinker to be going upwards, so that he should turn from the grave beneath. Okay. That is the verse, okay? So it's telling us a path of life, okay? The question is, I mean, the second half, I don't know what he's talking about. So he's turned away from the grave beneath. I mean, I don't know what he's talking about. But the first half, he says, to go, for the thinker to go up. What does that mean? What he's saying is, see, a thinker is constantly developing. Lamala means he's always going up. The thinker is always developing. He's going up step by step. Okay? If you are developing, even if you are not there, that lifestyle will protect you from going downward to destruction. Okay? He's saying that developing, being in the world of ideas, and even if you're not totally there yet, in a certain way, that will protect you from going downwards to the grave. Okay? The question is how, but that's what the verse seems to be saying. Lamala lamaskil, he's going upwards. He's going in a certain direction, which is away from the grave, okay? We don't know exactly how it works, but that's what the pasuk seems to be saying. You understand? Okay. Now, the answer is that it's telling us an idea like this. A person cannot be status quo, cannot stay in a certain position. I one time saw a metaphor of that. Oh, it says by Yosef, when they threw Yosef in the pit. So the pasuk says it was empty and there's no water. So the question is, what do you mean it's empty? So Rashi says, he quotes a Chazal, that it's talking about, but what was in there? There were snakes and scorpions. Where did Chazal get that? The answer is nothing could be empty. You see, something is either good or bad. It's moving in one direction or another. There's no status quo. You understand? There's no status quo. Nothing is empty. I mean, your land is either growing good grass or growing weeds. It doesn't stay empty. You understand? So the same thing with the human being. If you are not constantly developing, then by definition, you're going in the opposite direction. If you quit developing, then you go. Then by definition, you're going in the opposite direction. You must constantly learn. You must constantly be involved. He's not always learning. He may be in the life of justice. I mean, you know, there's different things. We're acting out the life of justice, whatever it might be. But you're working in a certain direction, a certain lifestyle. You understand? You're not working that lifestyle, then automatically you're going in the opposite. That's why it says to turn from the grave below. In other words, you're going in one direction or you're turning in the other direction. Because if you're going in the developing upward, then automatically you're turning away from the direction of going down to the grave. Destruction. Okay? Hey, the question is, why can't the person be neutral? Maybe a person develops to a certain point, and then he can relax. And he'll say, look, I've developed to this point, and that's it. I say, well, maybe he can keep the status quo. Why does he have to be going in the opposite direction? Okay, what's the what makes it necessarily true that you can't stay in one place where you at? In other words, the question is: we gave very nice metaphors, but the metaphors seem to work, but how does it work in the human being? Now, the answer is that a person has an unconscious. You understand? And therefore, the energy that, in other words, you're either using energy for the mind or thought or idea or actions of the mind, either thoughts or you're carrying out actions of the mind and living a certain lifestyle. If you stop that, then the emotions immediately take over. In other words, the emotions are always there to immediately take over the opposite direction. So if you stop, then the emotions take over. Okay? That's clear? And the question is what is the idea of Tisha B'Av, and what should you get out of Tisha B'Av, okay? I'm sure there are many different dances. We're going to do it from the point of view of the Musa, okay? Of the Musa point of view, not the metaphysical or through God. Okay. Now, when we sit down and study Musa, we start seeing that the life of pleasure, the physical attachment to the physical, by the word pleasure, I don't mean only parties. I do mean that parties, but I also mean the life of money, fame, power, pleasure, all those different things are attachment to the physical. We find that that life is not the good life. It doesn't lead the good life, but it leads to a tremendous amount of conflict. Okay? So the book of Mishlei and Musar will show you that the life of pleasure, the life of fame, power, money, all this life is an unhappy life. So the thing is really I should just live a life of just physically take care of myself, just eat enough to live, just have a little house to live in. But we find that because we're attached to the physical, you can't live that way. You're not going to be able to operate. So what we do is we only partake of the physical only insofar as I need to satisfy my psychological needs. But I don't go into pleasures that will take me away from the life of learning, because the life of learning, we see through Muslims, is the best possible life to live. Okay? So therefore, when on the level of Musar, if we are kind, why should we be kind to others? Because sometimes I have to be kind to somebody I don't like. You see? They run against my emotions. Oh, so that's good, because then I could see the emotion, and the emotion comes forward, the stupid emotion, why I don't want to help this guy, so then I could deal with it. So there's a certain amount of pain to help me get away from the attachment to the physical. You understand? It helps me get away because I'm able to see how far my emotions go away from reality, that I hate a person for no reason. You understand? And I don't want to be kind to him for no reason. I'm not talking about a reality. I mean, you should not be kind to a Nazi. You understand? We're not talking about in reality. They're evil people that you should not be kind to. But I'm talking about the people, regular people in everyday life. That for some reason, you know, emotionally, you don't like them. That's the person you should be kind to so that you can deal with your emotions and see the stupidity of your emotions. Because you see, the life of attachment to the emotions is not a good life. Okay? So the same thing with fast days. We have 6 fast days in Judaism. Fast day is just another way of turning away from the physical world, and it's a painful thing. So therefore, you turn away from the physical world. Okay? That is the first step. Now, there is a certain way of getting down to the unconscious. The unconscious is the part of us that looks at life in an incorrect manner. Okay? Now, in other words, when I said before, you live according to the psychological so you can operate, there's a certain point where you take one or two parts of that which is psychologically you need, you take away. You remove it. You see? And when you remove it, so the unconscious rebels and it comes to the forward, and you could watch the associations of the mind at that time. So when you see the associations, how your mind is thinking, how you feel when you're not being satisfied, when you took away a part of the physical that you're attached to, so it helps you investigate that part. Okay? Okay? Now the question is, each person should do that which they feel would help them when they're ready for it. If you're not ready for it, there's no reason to torture yourself. It's only if you're ready to do the investigation, okay? But we see that food was legislated on a national level, okay? I'd like to try to show why food is legislated on a national level, okay? If you ever fasted a full day, most people at the end of the day go and gorge themselves. It's not a very healthy thing, but okay, well, tomorrow I don't think I'll destroy it. It'll be terrible physically, you know? But the thing is that, now the question is, rationally, when you, if the fast, what is the rational way, the practical way of undoing the fast? Well, the practical way is to drink some water or juice or have a fruit. You understand? And since you haven't eaten for either whole, 12 hours in the day, or if it's 24-hour fast, you haven't eaten for 24, 25 hours. So usually if you have a little bit of fruit, you have a, you know what I mean, some fruit that you enjoy, that get the juices going in you, you eat very little, you fall. Insofar as physically, there's very little you need, you see. There's very, very few people, I've spoken to people about it, there's very few people that actually break their fast naturally this way. They just eat a little bit, and then they quit. And later on, they'll eat a little bit more and a little more, you know what I mean? But it's only to take care of their physical needs. Most people really have a problem with food. The proof is the fasting, even though you might be thin, but the fact is, food is a very deep, unconscious thing which God legislated on the national level because most people have a problem with it. It's not in the societal world. I mean, as long as you're thin, so then it's fine. Then you don't have a problem with food. Let's say a person only eats chocolate, but they're thin. They don't eat that much that they gain weight, right? So everybody says, oh, wonderful. You understand? He looks fine. You know what I mean? Looks healthy. To us, that is not a good life because he's attached to the physical. You understand? The biggest test, whether you're how much, most people, there are people that have different problems and not with food, and the fast day is not a big problem for them. And when they break the fast, it doesn't affect them psychologically that, at all, or very little that I could notice when I've spoken to these people. But most people, that's why we legislate according to most people. Most people do have a problem with food. And if you fast the whole day, what's going to happen? You're going to see that you relate to food in a crazy way, which means that there's an emotion here. So it's time to start investigating and deal with that psychological problem. Pull yourself away from the physical based on your unconscious feelings, right? So therefore, that's all fast days. And since sin represents an over-attachment to the physical, so wherever God punished us, where because we were over-attached to the physical, like by the destruction of the temple and by the by Haman, these type of areas, so since we don't have the temple, we don't have the Beis HaMikdash, and since we're still in exile, this shows that we're still living a life of sin. So therefore, the way to do it is to undo the thing that causes sin, namely our emotions, our unconscious part of us. So therefore, we legislated six fast days. Well, one is Yom Kippur. That was legislated from the Torah. But the other five was legislated by our sages later as a means of repentance. And because the fast is on a national level, which most people have a problem with. It says, the house of the haughty God will rip up, and he will make a stand or make firm the boundary of the widow. Okay? That's the pasuk. So the question is, what are the two sides of the verse? They don't seem to have anything to do with each other. Okay? So, okay. What's the opposite of haughty? Humility, right? And what's the opposite of a widow? The opposite of a widow is a married woman, all right? So the question is, what do we have the verse have to do with each other? So because of this, we'll learn widow as a metaphor. In other words, one quality. I mean, we have no choice, okay? And a widow, in other words, is a person in the when we say widow, it doesn't mean like somebody who's a widow that's very wealthy. When we talk about a widow, We're talking about somebody that is in dire need. And so it represents like humility, the idea of humility. Okay? So, I mean, that's the only way of learning the verse. I mean, that's the only way of learning it. Okay? So the question is, in what way is the house of the haughty uprooted? And in what way is the house of those that have humility stand firm? Right. The question that's being asked is, how does the word widow, let's put it this way, why did King Solomon use the word widow to represent humility? I mean, he had better terms of saying that, better ways of saying humility. Why did he exactly put it in that form? The person that is destitute, okay, has no choice to be successful, must recognize reality, must deal with reality. Person that has wealth, that has money, they can fake themselves out. They have the money, they can fake themselves out. That's why you see in wealthy societies, wealthy people are looking for all types of fantasies to satisfy themselves because they have all this time. They don't need the practical. They feel the money would take care of them. You see? So therefore, the almano, or the widow, represents a person that has no choice, that has to deal with reality or fail. You see? So it's a circumstance. Like you said, it's a circumstance that makes them deal with reality. While a haughty person is a person that doesn't deal with reality. They think they're above, that's haughty, I'm above reality. I don't need reality, you see? And once you stop dealing with reality, then you'll fail. And if you deal with reality, then you will be successful. In other words, over here, God means that God created the laws of nature. We're dealing within the laws of nature, okay? So it means that if you deal within the laws of nature, if you deal realistically with life, within the laws of nature, then you will be successful. And your boundary will be firm, okay? While the house of the haughty, meaning that people that don't deal realistically with life, even though they might be wealthy or powerful, whatever it is, they're going to be uprooted. They're going to be destroyed sooner or later. In verse 26, it says, it's an abomination of God, evil thoughts, and the pure speak Noam like pleasantly. Noam is pleasant. They have a pleasant type of speaking. Okay? First question is, what is an abomination? Right, the question is, one place says thinking, the other place says talking. I mean, doesn't seem to be the same subject. And the question is, what is pure? What does it mean pure? Tahor. What is tahor? Okay? And we've always said the term abomination of God means in a situation, in other words, there are certain consequences that I direct. Like we know there's a direct cause between smoking and cancer. Okay? Right. So we know there's a direct cause. But sometimes the cause is not direct. In other words, if a person cheats on their taxes, that doesn't mean they're going to become a murderer. But yet the thing is, once you start cheating, you can. You understand? It starts like suddenly you want more, and you start going more and take step by step. And it's not a direct, one is not a direct link to the other, but it can go through stages. Because people change. People don't stay in the same, they're not status quo. Their personality doesn't stay in the same way. So either they're developing towards the righteous or they're developing in the other way. So if you're making a move in the wrong direction, so therefore you might not see that the consequences could be so bad. But yet the consequences could be very bad. You don't notice because there's too many steps in between. That's what I've noticed about abomination. So the thing is that usually people hold that thoughts are not the reality. You understand? Reality is only is reality is only when I do an action. And my thoughts, and sometimes even speech, people don't hold as a reality. But however, actions they hold as a reality. So instead, I can think whatever I want. It's my business. It's none of your business. What I think is my private thought. That's all. It's only between me and my psychiatrist. Okay? But it says it's an abomination of God, meaning that that their evil thoughts it'll start leading to actions. Can't stay. It doesn't stay in the same place. It will lead to something. It will lead to something bad. The Ibn Ezra says the word pure means it's like pure silver. When you take silver or gold, when you take it out of the ground, it's usually mixed with other metals. It's not pure. Then what you have to do is go through a process to purify it. So the same thing with the human being is that they have, when everybody's born, they have a mixture. They have a mind and they have emotions. They have some good things, they have some good qualities and some bad qualities. It's all mixed in. So if you go in one direction, you go in one direction, so then you start removing the good qualities. You go in the other direction, you start removing the bad qualities. The end result of removing the bad qualities would be what? Would be purity. You understand? You'd be a pure mind. You have a clear mind, and you know how to think, and you know how to say, you know how to think correctly, so that when you speak, you understand? In other words, speaking is, in this case, is like represents the purity of mind. The pleasant, that's knowing to say the right thing at the right time and always knowing how to say the right thing, that's a result of a correct mind, of where the dross of the mind has been removed. So if the dross of the mind has been removed, so then you could think correctly. But if you're a person, so that's the end of the process of going, in other words, of removing the dross. But if you think incorrectly, the opposite, so then if you start thinking incorrectly, in other words, you let your jealousy think. You know, like, I'll give you an example. A lot of people think Lashon Hara is only speaking. Lashon Hara is a certain attitude of the mind where you're very negative about every human being. You know what I mean? Lashon Hara is a negative view of people. You say you're just always finding fault. So if you have a negative view of people, that's evil. After a while, it's going to lead to talking Lashon Hara and then to doing things. You understand? So if you don't straighten out the mind, those type of things, after a while, you'll start carrying it out. That's why it's an abomination. But you don't notice, well, I don't say anything. I only think it. It's nothing bad. It's my private thoughts. You see? That's why it's called an abomination, because you don't notice that these different thoughts, you understand, the desire for power, the desire for money, you understand, all these things can lead to problems. Later on, it could lead to certain actions, certain talking, and then actions. You see? People don't notice that. At the other end, if you undo it, then you'll be pure, meaning that when you speak, it'll show what's on your mind, how the purity of the mind, that you've undone all the dross that's mixed in with the good. You've undone that. In other words, it's talking about a process. That you might not notice, both of them, both ways are a slow process. That you sometimes think, you look at that person that's made it, I'll never be there. I'm just not that type of person. It's just not true. You can make it. You can. Every person can make it. The question is, how do you remove the bad thoughts? There's two ways. One is the training of the mind so that you think correctly. You must train the mind to think correctly about things. And then two, that we spoke many times. Sometimes it's just knowledge of reality. Sometimes it's knowledge of the consequences that could affect us. And sometimes you actually, if it's very deep, then at a certain point you have to do analysis. It's the last step. I wear up to chapter 15, verse 27. It says, he who seeks profits You can either say he's greedy. Okay, greedy is good. It will rip up, will cause troubles in his house. And he who hates presents, he will live. Seeking profits, what we're talking, seeking profits seems to be not too bad. But seeking profits, usually when it says Botea Betza, it means stealing. Usually it's going to mean stealing or greedy, but stealing, let's leave it at stealing, okay? Now, Rashi has an interesting thing. Rashi says that the person that hates present, certainly he'll hate stealing. Now, we still don't know what the opposites are, because according to Rashi, Rashi is saying that since he hates presents, he will certainly hate stealing, right? All right, so therefore, hating presents is not the opposite of stealing. It's just okay? In other words, it's not the opposite. Just, I don't know. We'll have to discuss what Rashi's saying. But anyway, the fact is we don't have the opposite yet. Let me give you a method here, okay? Whenever you have degrees, and you also find it in the Kal Vachomer, this will help you on the Gemara. Whenever you have a Kal Vachomer, there must be a subject or a quality that has different degrees, okay? Enunciate the quality. It's not that easy, okay? But if you find the quality, then where you're saying different degrees, like in Rashi, where you're saying one level and certainly the other level, or when you have a Kal Vachomer, if you know the subject, then it'll make a lot of sense. But if you don't know the subject and you're just trying to work out, what you're doing is working out the degrees, it's going to become vague and not clear. So the first thing, very clearly, define the subject that there has two levels. Like in Rashi's case, we'll have to define a subject that has two levels. Also, in every pasuk has opposites, they're also going to have a subject. Sometimes you have to look for the subject. Sometimes you have to understand the opposite. I mean, that's intuition, which direction you're going to go. But many times, knowing what the subject is will clarify, defining the subject will clarify the whole verse. Whether you get it at the beginning or later on, that's a different besukha. The question is, what is the opposite of hating presents? In other words, the opposite is liking presents or loving presents. Hating, the opposite would be love, right? Loving presents, desiring presents. Okay? Does that help you? In other words, loving material things, I could go out and work for it and buy material things. I could be wealthy and still have a love of material things, and I don't need presents from others. So it can't be a love of material things. That doesn't seem to be pointing to that quality. The answer is both of them desire the other people's things. Okay? One is, in other words, the only difference between the one that hates presents and the one that hates stealing is one wants it legally and one wants it illegally. Okay? But they both desire other people's things. They want other people, they want what other people have. They want other people. One, in other words, I'm putting in the positive. Loving presence is I desire other people's things that they should give it to me. Stealing is I want other people's things and I take it. I do it illegally. You see? They both have the same quality of desiring other people's things. In other words, when you buy something, it could also be because you buy something out of jealousy, because you want somebody else's thing, but you won't steal it, and they're not going to give it to you, so you buy it, so you have it, but it's really the desire is to take it from the other person. But that buying it would not show that quality, because you could buy it because you desire it, or you buy it not because other people have it, because you're attached to the pleasures of the physical. You want to own things in the physical. It's not necessarily jealousy when you buy. In other words, when you want things, there are different aspects of wanting, different desires to want. So one is the desire of the physical itself, but one is a desire because the other person has it. You understand? It's a type of jealousy. So because of that, in other words, when you bring these two qualities together the way Rashi did, when he said, well, one is certainly the other, the quality that we're talking about is I cannot tolerate, I desire other people's things. I desire other people's things. It's showing a certain jealousy. So if you desire presence, it means that you want something from somebody else. So the thing is, the first half of the verse is stealing. The stealing is because, not because I just want. Okay, if you learn the pasuk, you could just learn the pasuk, not this way. There are other ways to learn the pasuk, but Rashi connects it. The way Rashi learns it, that if you hate presence, you certainly hate stealing, that means there must be one quality. The quality is that I desire somebody else's things. Okay? Right. Now, even in presence, there could be different qualities. Like, for instance, in presence, it might be that I want to be loved by others. It shows love. You understand? But it's still, even if it shows that the person loves me when they get a present, it's still a need for the other person's thing. That's just a reason why I need the other person's thing. Yeah, I'm sorry, it is the same thing. Even if I want the thing because I want to feel love from the other person, that desire only is the quality why I want his things. But the desire is still I want his things, and the motive might be that I need love. Okay? But presence shows, the desire for presence shows that I want things from him, okay? And stealing shows also I want his things. Okay, I want to take it away from him. So according to Rashi, it seems to come out that a person that loves presence, it could be, a person that loves presence can actually steal because he desires other people's things. Okay? Because they're definitely putting them in the same category, which means that once they're in the same category, one could lead to the other. Just two levels of the same thing. So one could definitely lead to the other. He says, in other words, the consequence will be that that you will steal, and stealing, that will rip up your house. Okay? In other words, desiring other people's things, the question is it jealousy or not? Because sometimes you want a present because you want the person to show love, right? So you want the thing because he shows you love by buying it for you. But you definitely, when you get it, you definitely enjoy the object. You understand? There's an attachment to the object. In other words, that you get love through objects means you're attached to the object. You see? So therefore, it seems to be, according to Rashi, in this pasuk, that it could lead that if you desire presence, if you have an attachment to presence, then that's an attachment to other people's things, so that could lead to stealing. That's what Rashi seems to be saying. Now, if you hate presence, means that you totally, you get things because you need it, but not because you want somebody else's things, okay? That you want somebody else's things. It's because you need it, so then you live. But if you have the other quality, the quality of desiring other people's things, you see, so then that's a desire for other people's things. Once that happens, then it could lead to stealing. The possibility that it could lead to stealing, because you want other people's things, so then you can't get it, so you steal it. And the question is, and the consequences, one side says live, which we don't understand what do you mean live. And two, the other side means you cause troubles in your house. That doesn't seem to be the opposite. And what is he talking about? You cause troubles in your house. Ben Nachasson says that that the thing is that when you are jealous, when you need other people's things, it means you are not happy with what you have, and also with all your situations. So you go, that's going to be, start looking at other people, what they have in their situations. You're not going to be happy with your own family, because your own family, in other words, you're always looking at the other, what they have. So what you have, in other words, it shows the nature that you're not happy with what you have. When you're not happy with what you have, so then you're going to harm your own family. So therefore, you're going to destroy yourself. Therefore, the second half has a live. He has a life. By live, it doesn't mean physically. It means he has a life. His family, his household, I mean, he has a life. But if you have, if you desire other people's things, whether on the lower level of loving presence or the higher feeling, it means you're not happy with yourself. So if you're not happy with yourself, so then you're going to be unhappy with your situation, and therefore you'll cause problems in the home. And that shows, I mean, I just want to say that the way we're learning the pasuk shows that there was a possibility when we started out that the hating presence means you get a debt. You know what I mean? That you're in debt. That was a possibility at the start. And all I said was at that point, that's just not Rashi's approach. Okay, Rashi has a different approach. But I want to say our approach is right because you see it follows through from that quality what the punishment is. It follows through the punishment. So you see that we were, that the, Rashi's direction was the correct direction. Okay. In other words, it's very good because when you're jealous of somebody else, as soon as you take it, after a while you feel it's yours. You don't feel it's the other person. So then you're not happy with it again. So therefore you have to go and get more from others. That's why it's going to have to lead to stealing. That's really why it has to be to lead to stealing, because you're never happy with whatever you get. And even when you get it, you're not happy with it because you're not happy with what you have. Okay, verse 28, okay, it says, the heart of the righteous thinks about to answer, and the mouth of the wicked spouts evil. Now, once again, the heart of the righteous thinks before he speaks, and the mouth of the wicked spouts evil. Spouting, they say that the commentaries in the Ibn Ezra and the Mitzvot David says it's like a flowing water, like water flowing in a river, like flowing water. Spouts, like flowing, okay? So that's the metaphor, okay? They put it in a metaphor, like flowing waters, okay? So from there, okay, then we have to analyze what it means. The word heart over here means mind, the mind of the righteous, okay? It seems to be talking about that it comes from two different sources, the speaking of the righteous and the speaking of the wicked. There's two different sources. The flowing means that it's something that comes from within me and it flows out. It comes from my words and comes from within me and it flows out. Okay? So the thing is, it comes from within me and it has nothing to do with reality. While the tzaddik, on the other hand, what does he mean he thinks? He has to look at the facts. What, in other words, let's say, for instance, if you come into people talking, okay, just gossiping. Now, many times you'll notice what happens is that one person starts gossiping, and then the other person doesn't talk back to the person that's gossiping. That reminds me of something. Like, it's just a feeling, so now your feeling reminded me of my feeling, and now something starts flowing from me. But it doesn't have anything to do with each other, and they go from subject to subject as each person's feelings come up. You understand? It just comes up from them. That's the idea of the wicked. They speak evil, in other words, because it comes from within them. It has nothing to do with reality. you see, while the righteous thinks, what do you mean he thinks before he answers? It means he has to work out the reality. He has to make sure it's real, it fits into what is real in life. And if it doesn't fit in, then he can't say it. So therefore, he has to think it through. When it flows, because it just comes from your feelings, whatever you're feeling, you express. But the righteous express that which is real. Okay? What he's saying, that if you speak how you feel and just speak it out, that's coming out, you're speaking evil. It's evil that's flowing because it comes from the unconscious. By evil, we mean it has nothing to do with reality. It's just the way you look at life. In other words, it doesn't come from reality. It comes from a certain feeling, how you look at life. That's what evil is. In other words, evil according to this pasuk, is that reality doesn't make a difference. I don't allow reality to interfere with my life. I might think realistically in certain areas, but there's a part of me that's totally evil, and I allow it to go. I don't care. I enjoy it. You understand? I have nothing to do with reality. On the other hand, the tzaddik deals with reality. He can't answer before he knows that it's real. That's what it means. He thinks it out. It has to be real to him before he makes any decisions, before he even speaks. Verse 29. God is far from the wicked, and the prayers of the righteous he listens to. Once more, God is far from the wicked, and the prayers of the righteous he listens to. First of all, what does it mean far from the wicked, and what does one thing have to do with the other? One is talking about prayer, and one is talking about God's relationship to the wicked, that he's far from them. Whatever far means, it means that it's like nothing to do with, okay? Or maybe we'll define it clearer later. But I mean, it has nothing to do with them, right? And the other is talking about prayer. So it has nothing to do with each other. So if you're going to say that it has to do with prayer, in other words, you're talking about a person that prays to God, and yet he is still wicked. Okay, is that the way you want to learn the verse? Fine, okay. So we're talking about two people. One is the person, he turns to God, he prays to God, and he's considered wicked, right? And the second is the prayer of the righteous, God listens to, right? All right, who is the person that prays to God that is wicked, okay? And two is, what we asked before, what does this have to do with Proverbs? It should be in Psalms. I mean, prayer has to do with Psalms, not with Proverbs. What Cal wants to say is that by the wicked, since he's praying for a certain desire. Whenever you pray for a certain desire. You have a certain desire, okay? So what's the difference between the prayers of the righteous and the prayers of the wicked? Again, the question is, when you pray, you desire something. The question is, what's the desire of the wicked? What's the desire of the righteous? In other words, we're trying to get to the desire, but prayer is a means of showing us what that desire is. Okay? In other words, like this. And the wicked, in other words, by the wicked, it means that a person is attached to the physical world, and he turns to God because he wants something from the physical world. Says, hey, God, you know, I'll give you a prayer, like it makes a trade. I'll give you a prayer and you give me the physical or something like that. You see what I mean? But the main thing is the desire is the physical, you see? The tzaddik is a person that recognizes that the physical is not the good way. He turns away from the physical, you see? So insofar as Mishlei is concerned, it's showing that a wicked person is a person that's attached to the physical world. You see? It's not dealing with tefillah per se, but before you could pray to God, you must know simply from the muscle view, what is life? Is life the good life, the physical life? Or is the good life is the life of ideas? You understand? And not an attachment to the physical. Like an example was the verse 27, where we got the quality of desiring other people. desires what other people have. We showed how terrible it is and the consequences that lead to these things. So you start turning away from the physical. That's one aspect of the physical. But now we're in general, the general prayers. When a person turns to God and what we consider wicked is a person that's attached to the physical. That, if you attach to the physical, then that's wicked. God will not listen to your prayers. Distance means he won't listen to your prayers, right? Because he has nothing to do with you. But if you're a person that recognizes reality and you recognize that the physical, and you did an investigation, a clear investigation into the physical, and you see the physical is of no value. And so your desires is more in the world of ideas. Or even when you relate to the physical, it's only the physical becomes a means, like a practical means, you see? So therefore, the difference between the wicked and the righteous is, in other words, we're not talking about a wicked person that's a murderer. We're talking about that his attachment is to the physical world, but he's a religious person. You can't be a religious person till you go through Musa. That's what really we're starting to see throughout Mishle, that you can't become a religious person until you see the physical world for what it really is. If you see the physical world for what it really is, then it's just a natural step. You don't have to jump. It's just natural that they automatically you turn towards God. That tilling becomes a natural result of your knowledge of the physical world. But if you go directly to God and bypass Musa, so then you'll have the whole wrong view of God, the whole wrong view of the physical world. And the whole relationship with God is not based on reality because you don't have a correct view of what the physical world is. The question is, how exactly will you be distorted? The mind will be distorted if you lack Musa. In other words, like this. You say everything comes from God, okay? All right? Right? And therefore, I must turn to God for all my needs. But my needs are not based on spiritual or world of ideas. My desire is the physical. If I give up the physical, it's like a religious thing that I have to go to God and I can't, like, I'll give you an example. But sometimes a religious person is very jealous, or kids, I'll give you, kids are very jealous of people that don't keep Shabbos, don't keep kosher. Why? Because, look, they could go out to parties Friday night, they could go bike riding on Shabbos, they could go to movies, they could put on off lights and things, and it looks like a better life. You understand? They go traveling. They can stop off at a McDonald's. They can do whatever they want. But they're jealous of the people that, because kids are only attached to the physical, you see? So now what they're going to do, they're going to pray to God and ask them for what? What are they going to ask them for? Different physical things. Make it up to me, like, you know, what I don't have. So they pray to God. But they don't have a real understanding that the physical itself is not the essence of life. The physical itself is a big mistake. The attachment to the physical. The physical is only a means toward the world of ideas. You understand? In other words, the difference is when lovers look at the moon and an astronomer looks at the moon. You understand? Lovers look at the night sky. You know what I mean? It's attachment to the physical. One looks at the stars. The stars are a means to help them with their ideas of the universe. You understand? It's two different views of the world, the tzaddik and the rasha. So if you are a religious person, but you're still attached to the physical, in God's eyes, you're still a rasha. You're a wicked person. I have nothing to do with you. How can I listen to you? You understand? But on the other hand, if I go through the area of Musa, in other words, my mind sees before I get to God that the physical world, the life of the physical is not the real benefit, then it's a natural result to turn to God. It's not a jump. They are jumping. They really desire one thing, and then they jump to God. They desire the physical, and they jump to God, which is the spiritual. You understand? there's God forgive me, God this, which is a spiritual thing, but their attachment's not to the physical. That's without muscle. That's a big jump. You can't do that. But however, if you first go through Musa and your mind sees that the physical world in and of itself is of no value as the pleasure, the enjoyments of the physical world, the attachment to the physical world is really nothing, you see, then God is the natural result of who you are. Then yeah, well then the natural thing is to turn towards God. The natural result. And the mind will guide you towards there. Then you really be close to God. Then God can listen to your prayers. What I'd like to discuss today is we always talk about the perfection of the soul, right? There are three steps to the perfection of the soul, okay? The first is reality. What is reality? The second is an investigation of individual emotions. And the third is an investigation of the total personality. Okay? Right now, insofar as the first is concerned, what is reality? The best way of knowing what is reality in the area of Musa, where we're taking a certain view of life differently than what I thought before, there are two methods of knowing which is the correct view. And let's put it this way, there's two methods of knowing which is the incorrect view, okay? One is if there's a contradiction, and two, if there are consequences, okay? When you study Musa, basically you see the consequences. If you want to perfect the area of contradictions, I think the best book is probably Plato's Dialogues. Okay? That is means of getting a reality. That's the first stage that a person should discuss. What is real? Like, for instance, we discussed about why a person should hate presents, right? Okay? So when we discussed it, we showed the consequences of that type of lifestyle, so therefore we know that lifestyle is wrong. So the first thing is to know the lifestyle either by the consequences or by contradictions. The question was, why can't we just prove what is positive, okay? Let's say, for instance, you already know that the study of Torah is the main important thing. And you sit down because it's so important, you decide to put in 5 hours of work a day. But then you find either after a day or two, let's say first you find out after a day or two that you can't operate that long, so then you have a certain consequence that you can't operate. Well, let's say, for instance, you put in too much time, and after a month or 6 weeks, you might be able to do it with, you know, heavy doses for a month or 6 weeks, and then you break down. It might have to be more evenly keeled. You understand? So the only way you know, even in the right way, when the right way is too much, is only by recognizing the consequences. Okay, now for the second stage. Second stage is when I see that I can't live. In other words, I have to give myself a certain amount of time. Sometimes it's logic. I need review of these ideas again and again. And after I review it, suddenly I see in certain particular cases I can't live with it. So then I need to cure myself to live with it. Then I need my personality. I need those emotions which bring it out, okay? Now, how can you tell your individual emotions? There are a few ways. One way is a projection, like, for instance, lashon hara, okay? A gossip. Most gossip is a projection, okay? Now, once you project onto somebody else, so then you have to realize that that's something I'm trying to deny. That's a very hard maneuver to make. Jokes. Your jokes comes from you, a certain style that you enjoy, so that joke must show who you are. You understand? Something about you. And the slips show something about you. It's, those are all particular areas that you have to investigate. And also, another thing is that sometimes they have to understand, when I say Lashon Hara, it doesn't only matter what you speak, but it's a certain attitude in the mind. Sometimes you look at people and you say, boy, that guy's a jerk, and you look at a certain quality that he has without a real investigation. I'm not saying you don't have the right to investigate another person's personality. But if you do an investigation, that's one thing, and it comes from the fact. But if you notice you jump to conclusions, and then suddenly you realize, well, one minute, there are three other possibilities. Why did I jump to this conclusion? So then you have to accept that that's a projection, you see? And so therefore, that's the way you know. Now, there's one other thing that you have to be extremely careful of, and it's very, very difficult and very, very subtle. And that is this. If you look at the whole world, everybody holds their right. Okay? Right? When you have a certain superego, a certain conscience, right? So you hold your right and you see reality as that way. It becomes very clear, 100%. You understand? Now, if for some reason you accept the logical approach, many times you might see the logic, but you accept it based on your conscience and your superego. Every beginner must start out that way, because you must start out in your framework. When you start out in your framework, it must be from your conscience. In other words, you're accepting the logic or the logical life for some emotional reason, okay? And therefore, it becomes part of your modus operandi, but it's in the framework of the emotion. And it's not because ideas are real or because you're guided by ideas. You understand? I'll give you an example. There are certain people that they learn how to think, and the first thing they do is they enjoy going breaking people down. You understand? Now, you cannot tell me that, I mean, in other words, you could use the first stage, the method of cross-examination, as a tool for search, or you could use it as a weapon. You use it as a weapon, that means it's not real to you. You only see it as a means to destroy others. You understand? So therefore, it becomes, that in itself has to be analyzed. That in itself, that you use it, or sometimes you accept it in a good way, but the conscience, like let's say, for instance, I'll give you an example. One of the best incorrect motives that a person could have is that he has an image of himself of being a chacham, of being wise. So the thing is when he lives this lifestyle, so he sees himself as a wise person. But that part of him you don't notice. He doesn't notice that that's an image. That's a level already when he recognizes that, hey, I'm living by an image. It's not enough living by ideas. I'm living by a certain image. That's a level when he could recognize it. But the first stage, you don't even recognize these emotions. That's a big danger, that you don't recognize your relationship to the truth. That in itself has to be analyzed. Now, I'm just saying you have to notice this. In other words, it might be not right away. Maybe you shouldn't deal with it right away. Maybe you should wait a year or two. Maybe you should deal with other emotions. I'm just only trying to point out that the second stage of investigation is investigating particular emotions that affect your thinking process. In other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, I have a certain emotion, let's say jealousy, competition, rebellion, okay? But I notice it, and it's insofar as what I notice that it doesn't affect my thinking process. So the fact that I have these emotions, fine. Then as long as it doesn't affect my thinking process, then I don't have to deal with it. You understand? That's what I started out with. that if you see that you can't live, you make decisions differently than the principles that you're learning in Mishlei. So then you start seeing that there's an emotion that affects my thinking process. Now, once I have an emotion that affects my thinking process, that's the emotion I'm afraid of. That's the emotion I have to look for. But if I find that I have another emotion, let's say I have an emotion of vengeance, but I never take vengeance, or I always stop myself from taking vengeance. But if I actually take vengeance, so then that's affecting my thinking process, and then I have the first step of undoing it is maybe I have to go over the logic of why vengeance is harmful, the first stage, maybe the contradictions, the consequences, so that my mind, maybe that's what I need. Maybe I have to analyze the emotion of vengeance and see how stupid it is and what causes it and why I am vengeful. And each person might have a different, like we said, that there are people have patterns. Each person has a different pattern. We both might be vengeful, but in what cases we're vengeful and the way we're vengeful and the way we deal with vengeance might be different. That's when we have our different patterns. You see what I mean? So therefore, the thing is, this is all the second stage. And even in the second stage, when you see you're not thinking correctly, sometimes you have to go back to the first stage and say, maybe I should review all the consequences of that emotion, or review all the contradictions that show that type of action is an incorrect action. And then I have to investigate the emotion itself and how the emotion works and what the patterns are. That is the second stage. In other words, again, about, let's say, in other words, when we're talking about that your emotions affect your thinking process, it is possible that you learn Mishlei and you don't notice that it's affecting it. But through your study and through investigating different emotions, you start becoming more and more aware of yourself. Then suddenly you'll notice that there might be a certain emotion that's affecting your thinking process. Before, you might notice the emotion before that, but you don't see that it's affecting you, so then there's nothing you could do about it. Then just leave it. It's a waste of time to deal with. But the thing is, if you notice that it's affecting you at the time that you notice that it's affecting your thinking process, that is the time that you want to deal with it. Of course, if you notice there's five different things, then you can only deal with one. Or if you you can think about more than one, but usually it's better to deal with one at a time and work through it in every aspect. Okay? That is the second stage. In other words, let's say you have a certain emotion that's affecting your thinking process. You don't have to undo the emotion. All you have to do is be aware that the emotion is affecting you. That is many times enough to be able to, you still have the emotion, but since you're aware of it, you don't allow it to affect your thinking process. That is enough. You don't have to go further in investigating the emotion, only enough to be aware of the emotion so that it doesn't affect, or at least you're aware of it, so you recognize it, and then you can think rationally in the situation that you're dealing with. The second stage is really just to recognize the emotion. It's not really undoing the emotion. It's to recognize the emotion so that once you're aware of it, once you're consciously aware of it, and it's not unconscious, so therefore you could make rational decisions despite the fact that you have this emotion. You have made it that it doesn't affect you. You neutralized it. It's still there, but you neutralized it enough for you to think correctly. Then you should not go into the third step. That's enough. There's no reason to go to the third step. The third stage is that sometimes we recognize that there's something that I can't undo it this way, and it's affecting my decision making in large proportion. At a certain point, you need to undo. Yeah, the only way of undoing it at that point, if these things don't help,
So then at that point, then you must do a total analysis of who your personality is. And the only way I know is through psychoanalysis. That's the only way I know. Okay? And that's to do a total. Then you have to have the method of psychoanalysis, and that is the last result. The only time I would say to start a person with that is if a person recognizes he desires to learn, but neuroses don't allow him to learn or to develop. So at that point where he recognizes an unconscious thing is stopping his development and figuring out a particular emotion is not going to help, at that point he needs he has to evaluate, like anything else, he has to evaluate. I mean, you have to understand if you're going to change your personality, that could take like years. It could take 10, 15 years, that you're going to have to investigate. You're going to have to invest, okay, in this investigation. And it's a painful investigation. You have to make an evaluation whether it is worth it, whether you should or whether you shouldn't. Each case you have to evaluate. Like anything else, all the knowledge that you get from muscles evaluating, and naturally every step that you take, you will evaluate whether you need that step. You have to make an evaluation whether you need that step. The question is that maybe instead of taking the second step, maybe just deal with the first step, the third step, and undo the whole personality. The answer is that you have to understand that if you're going to do that, let me put it another way. Whenever you make a decision in Musar, there must be a cause. There must be an evaluation if it is worth it to do it. Just like anything you do, there must be an evaluation. Okay? Now, you have to understand that once you start investigating the total personality, you understand, you are taking away time from your development of learning. Musar, unless you're a neurotic and you can't operate, and so you have to put your time totally in in psychoanalysis, you're taking away time from your learning and taking away time for your development, even in the Musar, because you could be learning about different aspects of what is reality. You understand? So that's also a development. You're taking away time from that, and I don't see any practical reason. And there's a tremendous amount of pain. The deeper you go, the greater the pain. The first stage is the least amount of pain. The second stage is a little more pain. And the third stage is a tremendous amount. You can't imagine the anguish that you must go through to start free associating, and then you have resistances. I mean, it's just an unbelievable thing. The question is it worth it? And that has to be an investigation. You can't just jump. Many times the jump, you have to be careful that maybe the reason for the jump is an ego thing that I want to be perfect. So you got to be careful. It's not a practical thing, but there's an ego thing pushing you. That in itself has to be analyzed. Like in every decision, the best example that I saw of this is the introduction to the Duties of the Heart by Bachiyim Bakuda, where he says that maybe he shouldn't write the book because for two reasons. One is his language isn't perfect, and a person doesn't have a right to make a spectacle of himself in public because he doesn't have that good language. And the other thing is that he knows that the whole thing is he's constantly finding new things in it that he's not finished with the subject, so maybe he shouldn't write the book. And he says, well, maybe these arguments, maybe I'm only giving these arguments because I'm lazy. You see, in his evaluation, he knows to look that maybe there's an emotion, and he has to answer that, no, it's not that emotion, but it is really reality. You see? So he makes that. So the same thing, you must always be careful in every decision. There is always an emotion. This is really the second stage. There's always an emotion whenever you're evaluating. One minute, maybe it's my emotion that's making me do it. You see what I mean? So you have to investigate whether it's the logic that I'm being practical, or there's some powerful emotion. Like, for instance, in the case that you want to go through the third step, Maybe I'm looking for perfection, and therefore I'll go to the third step where I'm looking for perfection. So then you have to analyze perfection. And when you analyze perfection, the first step is to see the contradictions and or to see the consequences. You see? Then to look at the nature of the perfection. What is the nature of perfection? That would be the second stage. You see? But that would be the best way of going. But to get the go to the last step, I think you have to go with reality first. Reality must be first. A lot of people skip to the third step before they even know what reality is. Unless you know for sure you can't get reality because of certain neuroses, and you recognize the importance of reality, so then there's something else. But that should be that point. If you're not ready to make a real investigation whether you should, then you should check it out with somebody that you could talk it over with to see if what it is. That's when you need advice. When you can make such a big decision, that's when you need advice of other people to know whether you should make such an investment, which is going to take you away from learning. In other words, if it's because of your knowledge of psychoanalysis that you see certain qualities in psychoanalysis that could help you with the second stage, definitely use it. Because in a person should study psychoanalysis, they should have the knowledge. You know what I mean? Because that's a necessary knowledge that you must have. But whether you should do a total psychoanalytic study of yourself, that you shouldn't do. But if you have knowledge of the psychoanalysis and that could help you for the second stage, definitely use it. You should use any knowledge that you have of yourself, any knowledge of emotions to help you get to the to recognize what the emotion is and to deal with it. In fact, somebody one time told me that what he does is he free associates sometimes just to know what the emotion is, but not that he's doing a total analysis, but just to make sure he has the right emotion, and he knows that the best way of telling is through free association. Once he gets the emotion, then he deals with it on a logical level. You understand? So that might be a means of getting what your emotion is in this case, because people can make mistakes in what the emotion is. You understand? But if you're going to the third stage, it must be an evaluation that's what you need. It's, in other words, you sense that you're being destroyed unless you go that stage. You can't further your development. Something is stopping you in a very big way. Then you have to go into the third stage. But it should be something causing you to do it. It must be something practical, not some emotion. The question is what's the difference between step three and step two again? Step two deals with individual emotions. You understand? You're just dealing and isolating the particular emotion that is affecting your thinking process in this case. That's it. The third stage is a total dealing with the total personality based on your unconscious. The total, I mean, that could take years. You're talking about many years. In other words, the same approach would be with halacha. In other words, let's say if you're ignorant of halacha, so then you're just ignorant, so now you start doing it. But if you weren't ignorant of it, so then, and you just couldn't do it, so then there's a certain emotion that's stopping you. Then you would still work. In other words, the reality is the halacha. That becomes the reality because God told us to keep the halacha. By your God, it's a reality. But there's a certain emotion stopping me from doing it. So therefore, I have to investigate. I must go to the second stage. So it could be the first stage. Maybe I have to do an investigation of the reality of keeping Torah. Like to go over the reality either from the proof of Har Sinai. Maybe I need to review the proof of Har Sinai. Or maybe I have to review the value in my personal life of the halachic system. That's the first stage. Or maybe I have to see what emotion is taking me away. Sometimes the emotion is my relationship to all mitzvahs or to God. Or sometimes my emotion is in this particular mitzvah. But that needs the second stage of investigation when you're dealing with the mitzvah. Okay, then we're going to do Mishlei 15, chapter 15, verse 30. It says, Ma'ore Nayim, the light of the eyes, make the heart happy. Here it's literally the emotions. My heart of the emotions. And good news fattens the bones. It means it makes you healthy. Okay? So Rashi has two explanations. One is he takes it metaphorically. Metaphorically, Rashi says that what's the light of the eyes? That's Torah, right? And when you learn Torah, when you question and argue, and then you become very, very clear, so that makes you happy. That's the metaphor, okay? But he says the literal explanation is that you have a desire, that he has a desire to look with his eyes. And when he looks with his eyes, it makes his heart happy, and it removes conflict, it removes sadness and conflict, okay, of the heart. For example, he says, looking at a garden or flowing rivers, right? So he says that relaxes you and takes away worry, or takes away conflict and their feelings, okay? So the question is, according to the second way, why does that belong in Mishlei? What is it doing here? I mean, very nice advice, but Mishlei always, in fact, the Ibn Ezra learns this pasuk connected to the second, to the next pasuk, the next verse, and the way he says, this is a good way of undoing bad things, but the best way is to learn Musa, right? That's the way he connects it to the second verse. So he's using it as a means to say, yeah, in the physical world you could undo with the bad thing, but the better way, in other words, there's two methods of undoing when you're sad and you're down and you're out of it. There's two ways. One, you can do physical things, or two, you can investigate the source of it and undo the emotion altogether. So he says there's one way you could do it, but the main important thing is the second way, right? But Rashi doesn't say that. Rashi doesn't connect it with the second. He just seems to be learning it by itself. So according to Rashi, the question is, what is it doing in Mishlei? Is that according to Rashi, what he's saying is that sometimes I can't operate. In other words, sometimes there are two reasons why I should take a break through the physical. Okay, one is I've reached a point where I can't operate. I can't think. I need a break. So I can't think about the problem itself while I'm at the stage. Okay, so therefore I take a break. Or sometimes I know that dealing with it is going to take a month. I want to learn tomorrow. And so I might be able to deal with it, but it's through the correct way. But why should I put the time in? I'll just take a half-hour break, whatever I need, and then I'll be able to come back to learn. You understand? You got to be, in other words, you got to be careful of, even in Musar, getting involved in Musar could sometimes take an inordinate amount of energy that you could be learning and developing your skills in Gemara and Talmud and those type of things, because then you have to, it is pulling you that way, then you have to see what motion is pulling you, why it's pulling you that way, and not into the world of learning. So therefore, sometimes it's such a big deal, and it's, you know what I mean, to do a total investigation, the simple way is just take a break. You know, whatever it is, you go find some exercise, you go look at scenery, you understand, whatever your thing is. So you take your break and you come back and that's it, you know, you can work. But what are you going to do, spend months and years on the investigation? I mean, well, you could be learning. I mean, you understand. So therefore, you have to investigate practically what is the best way of dealing with this particular situation. Again, you need the investigation of, is it that this is a situation where I should get involved in my personality and investigate why, what's pulling me down? Or is it just that I need a break every once in a while, so I take the break so I can get back to learning? I have to know when and where. One more, just a clarification. The ancients used the term quiet pleasures and loud pleasures. By loud pleasures, they mean pleasures that draw you and destroy you. Okay? So you got to be very careful. There's certain pleasures that lead to terrible consequences. In other words, like this. Let's say taking certain drugs or getting drunk might be a good break. But however, the consequences of being attached to these things could be catastrophic. You understand? So therefore, you have to be, or there's certain pleasures where it draws the emotions where you, like in other words, like this. Going to a concert that makes it, in other words, you can listen to music and it's a good thing. You go to a concert, the whole atmosphere of the concert draws you. It draws you to a certain excitement that draws you to the whole thing. You see? But let's say I just need to listen to music. Fine, so you listen to music. You understand? Maybe even you dance or you do exercise with it or whatever it is. But there's a certain atmosphere that draws you, that that's the whole purpose of a concert, to make it, to give you a high. That high could be a dangerous thing. So you got to be careful of the high. Of the highs, you know what I mean? If it gives you a high, that's a very, then you have to start living up to that high. That high becomes a need. That high becomes an addictive. So you got to be careful between when you take a break, if you don't take the loud pleasures, but you take a quiet pleasure. I would like to define a little better difference between a loud pleasure and a quiet pleasure. The loud pleasure is something that draws you further into the pleasure. The quiet pleasure is you enjoy it and then you leave it. It's like any other activity, that it doesn't become greater because you don't want to be drawn. The whole idea is you don't want to be drawn to the physical world. So if you're going to take a break that draws you to the physical world, that's being destructive. What you should do is take a break that you could enjoy it. Like Rashi gives the example of scenery. You understand? But the thing is, there are other things besides scenery. Exercise is also a good thing. You understand? So the thing is just getting away. Sometimes the vacation you need, whatever it is. But the thing is, it shouldn't be something that you become attached to that it makes it a high. Because then you have to start, that becomes addictive to live up to that high or to recreate that high. That could become addictive, you see? So therefore, you have to be very careful of the loud pleasures.